This is Audible.
Double Eagle, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. Strong men have conquered the land. Bold men have conquered the void. Between land and void lies the sky, and only the bravest men ever conquer that. From the dedication to the Hessenville Aviator Skolam, Fantine. I give you command of the air. It is up to you how you take it. Warmaster Makarov, dispatch to Admiral Ornoff, 773.M41. We had planes. We flew them. They had planes. They flew them. There was some shooting involved. All that mattered, really, was who was still flying at the end of it. Major August Kaminsky, 73 kills, 6 weeks before his death, in 812.M41. I intend to get out of this alive if it's the last thing I do. Commander Bree Jagdia, at Uhrenberg. Part 1. Target found. Theda. Imperial year 773.M41. Day 252 to day 260. Chapter 1. Day 252. Over the Machanites. 0632. In the side rush of dawn, the peaks glowed pink, like some travesty of a fondant celebration cake. Hard shadows infilled the cavities like ink. Streamers of white cloud strung out in the freezing air 3,000 meters below. Hunt Leader was just a cruciform speck in the bright air ahead. He started to turn, 10 degrees to the northwest. Darrow tilted the stick, following, rolling. The horizon swung up and the world moved around. Slowly, slowly. He heard the knocking sound and ignored it. At least the inclinometer was still working. As he came around and leveled the column, Darrow reached forward and flicked the brass dial of the fuel gauge again. It still read full, which couldn't be right. They'd been up for 48 minutes. He took off a gauntlet and flicked the gauge once more with his bare fingers. He felt sure the lined mitten had been dulling his blows. The dial remained at full. He saw how pinched and blue his hand had become and pulled the gauntlet back on quickly. It felt balmy in his insulated flight suit, but the cabin temp stat read -8. There was no sound, except for the background rush of the jet stream. Darrow looked up and around, remembering to maintain his visual scanning. Just sky. Sun dogs flaring in his visor. Hunt 3, just a beam of him. A silhouette, trailing vapor. The altimeter read 6,000 meters. The vox gurgled. Hunt Leader to Hunt Flight! One pass west, and we turn for home. Keep formation tight. They made another lazy roll. The landscape rose up in his port vision. Darrow saw brittle flashes of light far below. Artillery fire in the mountain passes. He heard the knocking again. It sounded as if someone was crouching behind the frame of his armored seat, tapping the internal spars with a hammer. Pulse jets always made a burbling, flatulent noise, but this didn't seem right to him. He keyed his vox. Hunt Leader, this is Hunt 4. There was a sudden, loud bang. The vox channel squealed like a stabbed pig. The world turned upside down.
Oh, God Emperor! Oh, crap! God Emperor!
A voice was shouting. Darrow realized it was his own. G-Force pummeled him. His Commonwealth K-4T Wolf Cub was tumbling hard. Light and dark, sky and land, up and over, up and over. Darrow choked back nausea and throttled down desperately. The vox was incoherent with frantic chatter. Hunt 4! Hunt 4! Darrow regained control somehow and leveled. He had lost at least 1,000 meters. He got the horizon true and looked around in the vain hope of seeing someone friendly. Then he cried out involuntarily as something fell past his nose cone. It was a wolf cub, one wing shorn off in a cascade of torn struts and body plate. Flames were sucking back out of its pulse jet. It arced down and away like a comet, trailing smoke as it went spinning towards the ground. It became a speck, a smaller speck, a little blink of light. Darrow felt his guts tighten, an acid froth inside him. Fear, like a stink, permeated the little cockpit. Something else flashed past him. Just a glimpse, moving so fast. There and gone, a memory of recurve wings.
Hunt four, brake, brake and turn! There's one right on you!
Darrow leaned on the stick and kicked the rudder. The world rolled again. He put his nose up and throttled hard. The wolf cub bucked angrily, and the knocking came again. Throne of Earth. He'd thought his bird had malfunctioned, but it wasn't that at all. They'd been stung. Darrow leant forward against the harness and peered out of his cockpit dome. The aluminoid skin of his right wing was holed and torn. Hell's teeth. He'd been shot. He pushed the stick forward to grab some thrust, then turned out left in a hard climb. The dawn sky was full of smoke, long strings of grey vapour and little black blooms that looked like dirty cotton. Hunt Flight's formation had broken apart, and they were scattering across the heavens. Darrow couldn't even see the bats. No, that wasn't true. He made one, bending in to chase Hunt Five, tracer fire licking from its gun pods. He rolled towards it, flipping the scope of his reflector sight into position before resting his thumb on the stick-top stud that activated the quad cannons in the nose. The bat danced wildly across the glass reticule of the gun sight. It refused to sit. Darrow cursed and began to utter a prayer to the God Emperor of mankind to lift his wings and make his aim true. He waggled the stick, pitching, rolling, trying to correct, but the more he tried, the more the bat slipped wildly off the gun sight to one side or the other. There was a little smoky flash ahead, and suddenly Darrow's wolf cub was riding through a horizontal pelt of black rain. Not rain. Oil. Then debris. Pieces of glittering metal, buckled machine parts, shreds of aluminoid. Darrow cried out in surprise as the oil washed out his forward view. He heard the pattering impact of the debris striking off his noseplate and wing faces. The bat had chalked Hunt Five, and Darrow was running in through the debris stream. Any large piece of wreckage would hole him and kill him as surely as cannon fire, and if so much as a demi-mil cog went down the intake of his pulse jet. Darrow wrenched on the stick and came nose up. Light returned as he came out of the smoke belt, and slipstream flowed the oil away off his canopy. It ran in quivering lines, slow and sticky, like blood. Almost immediately, he had to roll hard to port to avoid hitting another cub head-on. He heard a strangled cry over the vox. The little dark green interceptor filled his field of view for a second, and then was gone back over his shoulder. His violent roll had been too brutal. He inverted for a moment and struggled to right himself as the mountains spread out overhead. That knocking again. That damn knocking. He was bleeding speed now, and the old pulse engines of the K-4Ts had a nasty habit of flaming out if the airflow dropped too sharply. He began to nurse it up and round, gunning the engine as hard as he dared. Two planes rushed by, so fast he didn't have time to determine their type. Then another three went perpendicular across his bow. They were all wolf cubs. One was venting blue smoke in a long, chuffing plume. "Hunt leader! Hunt leader!" Darrow called. Two of the cubs were already climbing away out of visual. The sun blinded him. The third, the wounded bird, was diving slowly, scribing the sky with its smoke. He saw the bat clearly then. At his 2, 500 meters, dropping in on the cub it had most likely already mauled. For the first time in his 4 weeks of operational flying, Darrow got a good look at the elusive foe. It resembled a long, sharp, elongated axe head, the cockpit set far back above the drive at the point where the bow of the wing blades met. A Hellraiser-class interceptor, the cream of the arch-enemy's air force. In the dispersal room briefs, they talked about these killers being blood-red or matte black, but this was pearl-white, like ice, like alabaster. The canopy was tinted black, like a dark eye socket in a polished skull. Darrow had expected to feel fear, but he got a thrill of adrenaline instead. He leaned forward, hunched down in the wolf cub's armored cockpit, and opened the throttle, sweeping in on the bat's five. It didn't appear to have seen him. It was lining up, leisurely, on the wounded cub. He flipped the toggle switch, guns live. Closing at 300 meters, Darrow rapidly calculated his angle of deflection, estimated he'd have to lead his shot by about 5 degrees. God Emperor, he had it. He thumbed the firing stud. The wolf cub shuddered slightly as the cannons lit up. He saw flash flames licking up from under the curve of the nose cone. He heard and felt the thump of the breech blocks. The bat had gone. He came clear, pulling a wide turn at about 270 kilometres an hour. The engagement had been over in an instant. Had he killed it? He sat up into the clear blister of the canopy, like an animal looking out of its burrow, craning around. If he'd hit it, surely there would be smoke. The only smoke he could see was about 1,000 meters above in the pale blue sky, where the main portion of the dogfight was still rolling. He turned. First rule of air combat, take a shot and pull off. Never stick with a target. Never go back. That made you a target. But still, he had to know. He had to. He dipped his starboard wing, searching the peaks below for a trace of fire. Nothing. Arrow leveled off. And there it was, right alongside him. He cried out in astonishment. The bat was less than a wing's breadth away, riding along in parallel with him. There was not a mark on its burnished white fuselage. It was playing with him. Panic rose inside pilot cadet Enric Darrow. He knew his valiant little cub could neither outrun nor outclimb the Hellraiser. He throttled back hard and threw on his speed brakes, hoping the sudden maneuver would cause the big machine to overshoot him. For a moment, it vanished. Then it was back, on his other side, copying his brake dive. Darrow swore. The Hellraiser class were vector thrust planes. He was so close to it that he could see the reactive jet nozzles on the belly under the blade wings. It could outdance any conventional jet, viffing, braking, even pulling to a near hover. Darrow refused to accept he was outclassed, refused to admit he was about to die. He twisted the stick, kicked the rudder right over, and went into the deepest dive he dared execute. Any deeper, and the wolf cub's wings would shear off its airframe. The world rushed up, filling his vision. He heard the pulse jet screaming. He saw the glory of the mountains ascending to meet him. His mountains. His world. The world he had joined up to save. Behind him, the pearl-white enemy machine tucked in effortlessly and followed him down. Theda, MAB North, 0702. Sometimes. Times like this perfect dawn, for instance. It amused August Kaminsky to play a private game. The game was called Pretend There Isn't a War. It was relatively easy in some respects. It was quiet, and the night chill was giving way to a still cool as the sunrise came up over the city. From where he sat, he could see the wide bay, hazy in the morning mist, and the sea beyond it, blue-grey, glittering. The city of Theda itself, a mix of pale rock-grete towers, low-rise habstacks and pylon steeples, was peaceful and quiet, huddled on the wide headland in a quaint, antiquated manner, as it had done for 29 centuries. Seabirds wheeled overhead, which spoiled it slightly because he envied them their wings and their freedom. But still, at these times, it was easy to play the game. Theda was not Kaminsky's birth town. He'd been delivered, a silent, uncomplaining infant, 42 years earlier, and 3,000 kilometres north, in the great hive of Enothopolis, on the far side of the Ziphonian Sea. But he had unilaterally adopted it. It was smaller than the great hive, prettier, a littoral town that understood the mechanisms of the sea, and, with its universitariat and its many scolams, was famous as a seat of learning. It was older than the great hive, too. The old town quarter had been standing for 300 years when the first technocrats began sinking their adamantine pilings into the Erspon Peninsula to raise Enothopolis. Theda, dear old Theda, was one of the first cities of Enothis. Kaminsky had adopted Theda partly because of its distinguished past, mostly because he'd been stationed there for 6 years. He'd come to know it well, its eating houses, its coastal pavilions and piers, its libraries and museums. It was the place he'd always longed to return to every time he snapped the canopy shut and waved the fitters away. And it was the place he always had come back to, even the last time.
You there, driver!
The voice broke through his thoughts. He sat up in the worn leather seat of the cargo transport and looked out. Senior Pynchon, the Munitorum dispatcher, was coming over the hard pan towards him, 3 aides wobbling along in his wake, like novice wingmen. Pynchon's long robes fluttered out behind him, and his boots were raising dust from the dry earth. His voice was pitched high, like the seabird's calls. Kaminsky didn't like Pynchon much. His game was ruined now. The senior's call had made him drop his eyeline to take in the ground and the airfield, and no one could pretend there wasn't a war when they saw that. Kaminsky opened his cab door and climbed down to meet the senior. He'd been up since 5, waiting for dispatch, sipping caffeine from a flask and munching on a coil of wisp bread. "Senior," he said, saluting. He didn't have to. The unctuous man had no military rank, but old habits, like Kaminsky himself, died hard. Pynchon had a data slate in his hands. He looked up and down Kaminsky and the grubby transport behind him.
"Driver Kaminsky, A. Vehicle 167.
"As you well know, senior," said Kaminsky. Pynchon made a check in one of the boxes on his slate.
"Fueled and roadworthy?"
Kaminsky nodded. "As of 0500. I was issued coupons for 60 litres of 2-grade, and I filled up at the depot before I came on duty." Pynchon checked another box.
"Do you have the chit?"
Kaminsky produced the paper slip from his coat pocket, smoothed it flat, and handed it to the senior. Pynchon studied it.
60.003 litres, driver.
Kaminsky shrugged. "The nozzle guns aren't really accurate, senior. I stopped it when it wound over 60, but the last few drops."
"You should take care to be more accurate," Pynchon said flatly.
One of his aides nodded. "Have you ever fueled a vehicle from the depot tanks, senior?" Kaminsky said lightly.
"Of course not."
"Well, if you had, you might know how tricky it is to get the wind exact."
"Don't you blame me for your inaccuracies, driver," Pynchon sputtered. "Essential resources such as fuel must be managed and rationed to the milliliter. That is the task of the Holy Munitorum. There's a war on, don't you realize?"
"I had heard." Senior Pynchon ignored him and looked at the nodding aide.
"What's 0.003 of a litre, 2-grade, at base cost?"
The aide made a quick calculation on his pocket slate.
"Rounding down, 10.5 credits, senior."
"Round up and deduct it from the next wage slip of driver Kaminsky A."
"So recorded, senior."
Pynchon turned back to Kaminsky.
"Transportation run. Personnel. Pick up within 30 minutes from the Hotel Imperial in..."
"I know where it is."
"Good. Convey them to the dispersal point at MAB South. Do you understand?" "Fine. Then sign here."
As he signed his name, his stiffened fingers struggling with the stylus, Kaminsky asked, "Are they flyers? Navy flyers, at last?" Pynchon huffed.
"Not for me to say. There's a war on."
"You think I don't know that, senior?" Kaminsky asked. As he took back the slate and the stylus, Pynchon looked up at Kaminsky's face and made eye contact for the first time. What he saw made him shudder.
"Carry on, driver," he said, and hurried away.
Kaminsky climbed up into his battered transport and turned the engine over. Blue smoke coughed and spurted from the vertical exhausts. Lifting the brake, he rolled the 10-wheeler down the gentle slope of the hardpan and drove off along the field circuit trackway, following the chain-link fence. The game was certainly ruined now. No pretending anymore. Here were fuel bowsers, smeared with treacly black promethium waste, armored hangars, repair sheds reverberating with the noise of power tools, lines of primer coils on their trolleys, electric munitions trains parked and empty on verges of swishing sapgrass. And airstrips, cracked rockcrete looking like psoriatic skin in the early light, with 8 engine bombers sulking on their hardstands, props like saber blades raised in threat, hook-winged Shrike dive bombers under tarps, fitters and armorers working around them. Beyond the strips, facing the sea, lay the long launch ramps of the Wolf Cubs, stretched out like exposed spinal cords, glinting and skeletal in the rising sun. 5 Wolf Cubs sat on taxi racks at the head of the ramps. Bottle green with gray undersides, they were tiny, one-man planes with stubby wings and tails, their rocket engines raised above their backs, their nose guns muzzled. They looked squat, leaden. But Kaminsky knew how they felt to fly. He knew how they rose off those catapult ramps, throttles right back, pulse engines farting and popping as the airflow fired them to launch velocity. The belly-dropping jink as they cleared the ramp end and lifted up into the blue, raw and throbbing. The cold smell of the cockpit. The reek of rubber and steel, promethium, nitrous, physoline. The feel of being aloft, alive. God Emperor, how he missed it. At the gate, beside the stake rivets and the heavy blast fences, he pulled over to let a munitions convoy roll in. He glanced up into the driving mirror and, for a moment, saw himself. More than anything, more than even the airfield full of prepping warplanes, the sight of himself reminded August Kaminsky that his cherished game was only pretend. There was, inescapably, a war on. Theda Oldtown, 07-09. He couldn't sleep. It was anticipation, mostly, the prospect of a new war to survive. But his body clock was still running on shipboard time, and to him it was late afternoon. Just before 6, by the chronograph on his nightstand, he gave up on his bed and got up. It was cold, and not yet light. In the adjacent rooms, the other men of G for Greta were sleeping. He could hear snoring, particularly the volcanic rumble of Bombardier Judd. The Munitorum had issued them billets in a once handsome pension on Kazagat Canal, and they'd piled in late the previous afternoon, leaving their packs in a heap in the hallway, eagerly laying claim to rooms. The younger men had broken open liquor and got down to the business of getting drunk so they could better sleep off voyage lag. He'd had a glass or two, but the cheap escape held little attraction. He and the other flight officers had swung the best rooms. He'd had to order a disappointed Orzone out to make way for him. "Find somewhere else," he told the young tail gunner. But the room wasn't much of a trophy. The carpet had long gone, and the plaster was crumbling. Pitch-washed sheets were nailed over the windows in place of curtains. Damp patches blotched the ceiling like sores. There was a smell of fatigue and faded grandeur. That's what years of warfare did to a place. They certainly did the same to a man, after all. The old woman who ran the pension had told him that there would be no hot water until after 8, and he hadn't come that many parsecs to start a tour by standing under a piss-cold shower. He'd got dressed in the half-light, boots, breeches, fleece vest, and started to pull on his flight coat. But his fingers had then encountered the insignia sewn into the thick quilts of the garment, the captain's bars, the squadron badge, the name strip that read Viltri, Oscar. He had put it aside and opted instead for a more anonymous tan leather coat. The landing was dark. On the floor above, the crewmen of Hello Hellstorm were slumbering, with the crews of Throne of Terror and Widowmaker on the floor above that. The retinues of K for Killshot and Get Them All Back were billeted on the ground floor. The other 6 crews of 21 Wing, Halo Flight, Imperial Fantine, Air Force, were tucked up in another pension down the street. Viltri activated a glow globe. The light was dim, but enough to light his way down the creaking staircase. In the hall, there were ancient books stacked on the mantel of the ornate but flaking fireplace, but those that he touched in the hope of finding an hour or two's distraction fell into dust. He let himself out onto the street. It was chilly and quiet, except for the gurgle of the canal. A van rumbled by on the far side of the canal, its headlights cowled as per blackout procedures. He walked a few paces, noticing the stumps, regularly spaced, where iron lampstands had been removed from the boulevard for the war effort. He tried to imagine the place in peacetime. Elegant, glass-hooded lamps, purring electric cruisers on the Grand Canal, prosperous imperial citizens going about their business, stopping to greet and talk, dining at terraced taverns, now long boarded up. There would have been students, too. The briefing document said that Theda was a Skolam town. In truth, he realized, he knew precious little about Enothis. Precious little apart from 3 things. It was an old, proud imperial world. It was strategically vital to this zone of the Sabbat worlds. And he, and thousands of other aviators like him, had been drafted here from off-world at short notice to save it from extinction. He noticed passers-by suddenly. Other pedestrians out in the early light, dressed in dark clothes, all hurrying in the same direction. He heard the chime of a chapel bell ringing out 7 of the clock, calling them to worship. Viltri followed them, crossing a bridge over the canal, hanging back. By the time he reached the Ministorum Chapel on the far bank side, the dawn service had already begun. He stood for a moment outside, listening to the plainsong chants. Above him, in the cold grey light, the bas-relief facade showed the figure of the God Emperor gazing down on all mankind. Viltri felt ashamed. He bowed his head. When, 8 years earlier, he had sworn to give his life as a warrior in the service of the God Emperor, he hadn't realized how damn hard it would be. He'd always wanted to be an aviator, of course. Fantine's unusual topography bred that instinct into all its sons and daughters. But the cost had been great. 2 years before, during the final onslaught to liberate his homeworld from the toxic clutches of the arch-enemy, fighting alongside the Imperial Crusade forces of Warmaster Makaroth, he had almost died twice. Once as Wind Waste over the Scald, then as a prisoner of the vile warlord Sagittar Slaeth at Uremberg. In the 2 years since then, Viltry had been unable to shrug off the idea that he should be dead already. He was living on borrowed time. His tutor at the Skolam had drummed into him the concept of fate's wheel. He'd said that it spun at the Emperor's right hand. It spun for balance, for symmetry. What was given would be taken. What was loaned would be paid back. A life saved was only a life spared. His had been saved twice over. There was a reckoning to be had. And here he was on another world, charged with the duty of fighting to save it. The reckoning would be here. He was sure of it. Fate's wheel would turn. He had been spared twice so he could live long enough to see his home world saved. Now he was fighting to save another man's home world. This, surely, would be where the accounts got squared. The crew of G for Greta had seen this fatality in his every action. He was sure of that. They knew that they were flying on a doomed bird. Doomed by him. Cursed by him. He'd lost one crew over the Scald, and he should have gone with them. Now fate's wheel would bring another crew down with him, in its efforts to even the tally. He'd asked for a transfer, been refused, asked for a non-operational posting, had that turned over as well. "You're a bloody fine flight officer, Viltry," Ornoff had told him. "Get rid of this fatalistic nonsense. We need every man bastard with airtime and combat experience we can get. Enothis will be tough as nails. Our ground forces are in hard retreat from sex legions. It'll come down to a bloody air war, mark my words. Request denied. Your Navy transport leaves orbit tomorrow at 0600. Viltry looked up at the graven image of the God Emperor, hard-shadowed in the sluggishly rising sun. It looked disapproving, scowling at his timid soul, fully aware of the cowardice in his heart.
"I'm sorry," he said out loud.
A woman in a long black coat, coming late to the service, looked round at him. He shrugged, bashful, and held the chapel door open for her. Light and a chorus of triumph, dedicated to the golden throne of earth, washed out on them both. She hurried in. He followed her, and closed the heavy door behind him. Over the Machanites, 07-11. This one was good. Daring. Young, most likely. Desperate to live. Weren't they all? The dive was magnificent. Foolhardy. Flight warrior Krell Cass Obercombe, chieftain of the fifth echelon, which was of the Anarch, and so sworn to he that is sec, decided he would like more of this boy's kind in his echelon, come the showdown. The boy flew, as they say, by the claws. Such a scream dive. Obercon didn't know the runty little enemy pulse jets could achieve that. It seemed almost a waste to slay him. Wound tight in his grav armor, auto pumps and cardio centrifuges compensating his circulation, Obercon committed his Hellraiser steeper still, adjusting the trim, slicing down through the air like a knife at 0.8 of Mach. His cockpit was dark save for the winking lights of his instruments, which reflected off the black, patent leather gauntlets encasing his hands. The stooping wolf cub was a bright orange pip on his Auspex display. How was it surviving? Pilot skill or luck? The young had little of the former and, sometimes, barrels of the latter. The dive was testing the enemy plane right to the limits of its airframe. A single degree deeper, and the descent would strip the wings away at the cabane or blow out the inductive motor. Behind the matte black glass visor of his full head helmet, Obercon smiled. His face, so seldom seen, was a grizzled tissue of fiber and polyweave reinforcements. His eyes were augmetics, linked directly to the warplane's gunsights by spinal plugs. At 300 meters, the wolf cub pulled out, dragging a long, aching turn up and away to avoid the ragged peaks, its jet engine spitting and foundering. Another surprise. Another admirable display of skill. Or luck. Obercon tilted his stick and nudged the reactive thrusters, pulling out of the dive non-ballistically, mocking the labored struggles of the smaller plane. It had been locked in his gun sight for 2 minutes now. The target finder was chiming over and over again. Attention. Target found. Target found. Target found. Why hadn't he killed it? I want to see what you've got, Obercon thought. The wolf cub veered around a peak top, letting the cross of its shadow flicker across the sunlit snow, then tipped its wings hard to steer around another crag. Obercon kept his Hellraiser almost level, to execute a following path, ripping through the air like a heat-hungry missile. The wolf cub was still in his crosshairs. Suddenly, around the next peak, it disappeared. Obicon frowned and swung about, assuming the boy had finally misadventured and flown into a cliff wall. For the first time in nearly 3 minutes, the target finder bleeped, "Lost lock, lost lock, lost lock." No, not dead. There he was. The little wretch. He'd somehow flick-rolled the wolf cub around the promontory and swung back the way he'd come, gunning low on full thrust. Obicon lifted his shiny black-clad hands off the stick and clapped. Very fine indeed. A warning note sounded, and Obicon snapped it off with a curse. He was down to reserve now, almost at the critical fuel threshold. That meant he had no more than 2 minutes left before he had to turn for home. More than that, and he wouldn't make it to Nattrab Echelon Eerie.
"Game's done now," he hissed through chapped lips.
He surged the Hellraiser forward, and it went fluidly, responding perfectly, sure as a shark.
"Reacquire,"
he told the autosight. He'd made 5 kills already, another ace day, but this boy would make a nice round 6. He'd dallied too long, playing games. The target pipper chased and bleeped. The wolf cub was pulling wide rolls and staying low, keeping the twisting furrows of the peak line between itself and the hunter. Target denied. Target denied. Target denied. Obicon cursed in the name of his most foul god. The little bastard was slipping away. By the skin of his teeth. By the claws. He had allowed too much grace. Now the enemy was mocking him. He got a partial target, then lost it again as the fugitive wolf cub banked perilously around a crag. They both passed so close that snow blizzarded up off the crag in their combined wash. Another partial. Obicon fired. Dazzling traces laddered away from his machine and cut the cold, mountaintop air. Miss. Another turn. Another partial. Another futile burst. Obicon throttled up and soared around, using reactive thrust to viff his machine out wide on the wolf cub's 8. It was running for all it was worth, burning at full thrust. Obicon got a true tone at last. Target lock. Target lock. Target lock.
"Good night,"
he muttered, bored of the game now. Hard-wired thumbs dug at the trigger paddle. Cannon fire lanced down through the air ahead of him. Obicon felt a tiny vibration, and a sudden display told him he'd been holed in one wing sweep. Out of the sun, a second wolf cub was diving on his tail, its nose lit up with muzzle flash. Just a glance told the expert chieftain that his second cub was piloted by an idiot, a man far less capable than the spirited boy he had been chasing. It was coming over too shallow, wobbling badly, desperately. It had no real target lock. But still, it was behind him, and gunning madly. The warning sounded again, impatient. He'd reached critical fuel threshold. He was done here. Enough. Obicon traversed the reactor ducts and powered off almost vertical, pulling out of the chase. The second wolf cub went by under him as he climbed, bemused by the sudden exit. Obicon climbed into the sunlight, gaining altitude and speed. He turned his beloved Hellraiser south. This broiling air war was just getting started. There would be another day. And another kill. Hotel Imperial, Theda, 07-23. Kaminsky made a good run across the northern sectors and arrived outside the Hotel Imperial well inside the time Senior Pynchon had allocated for the job. The only slight delay had been a queue of market stallers lining up to get onto Congress Plaza for the midweek moot. These days, it seemed to Kaminsky, the old town kept to its bed until after 8, as if afraid of what horrors might roam in the dark hours of night. He rolled in under the wrought-iron frame of the hotel's awning, quietly wondering how long it would be before even that was taken for war metal, and glanced around. There was no one about, except for an ancient old porter, dozing on a folding chair amongst a half-dozen deactivated cargo servitors and a gaggle of housekeepers smoking low sticks together by the service door down the side of the building. Kaminsky was about to get down out of the cab when the glass and varnished wood of the hotel's front doors flashed in the early sunlight, and a mob of dark figures strode out purposely towards him. They were flyers, he knew that at once by the swagger of them, but not locals. Nor were they wearing the black and grey coats and flight armor of Navy aviators. There was at least a dozen, dressed in quilted taupe flight suits and brown leather coats, carrying equipment packs loosely over their shoulders. They were unusually tall and well-proportioned individuals, slender and uniformly black-haired, where the average Enothian was robust and fair. and they weren't all male. At least three of them, including, it seemed, the figure leading them towards the transport, were women. Kaminsky got out and walked round to the back of the transport to drop the tailgate. He nodded a greeting to the first of the newcomers, trying to get a decent look at the insignia on the coat sleeve, but the young man spared him not a second glance and simply hoisted in his kit bag and climbed up after it. Only the woman paused. She had cold, searching eyes and a slim jaw that seemed to be set permanently in a gritted clench. Her black hair was cut unflatteringly short.
"Transport to Theda MAB South?"
she asked Kaminsky. She spoke with an off-world accent that sounded rather odd and nasal to him.
"Yes, mademoiselle, to the dispersal station."
"That's Commander,"
she corrected, hauling her lithe figure up into the transport.
"Carry on."
Kaminsky waited for the last of them to climb aboard, then shut the gate. He limped back round to the cab and started the engine. Fantine. That's what it had said on the woman's silver shoulder badge. Fantine 20, embossed on a scroll backed by a double-headed eagle that clutched lightning bolts in its talons. Kaminsky had been a student of aviation history since childhood, and, though he'd heard of a world called Fantine, he had no idea why a flight wing should bear that name. He drove them through Vilburg Borough and turned south towards the base. On Skullestay Street, a pair of Commonwealth Cyclones went over at about 500 meters, turning north and west. Kaminsky looked up to watch them pass. In the driving mirror, he saw the flyers in the back do the same. Theda Old Town, 0735. The service had finished, and the faithful were filing out, most stopping to light candles at the votary shrine. Candles for the lost, or those who might soon be. As usual, as she did every morning, Becca Mayer lit three. One for Gart, one for her brother Ido, and one for whoever might need it. She was tired. Night shift at the manufactory had really taken it out of her. It had been a struggle not to sleep through the hierarch's reading. If she'd been any warmer, she surely would have dozed off. But her coat was too thin. A second-hand summer coat. Not even lined. Perhaps next month, with her next wages and what she had put aside, she'd be able to pick up a thermal jacket or better from the Munitorum almshouse. As she turned from the candle stand, she knocked against someone waiting their turn to light an offering. It was the man she'd seen by the church door on her way in for the service. Tall, dark-haired, an off-worlder. He had a sad face. He was dressed like a soldier, and had that scent of machine oil and physoline about him.
"My pardon, mademoiselle," he said at once.
She nodded, no harm, but kept a distance as she went by. He'd been talking to himself when she'd first seen him. A stranger, maybe with battle psychosis. That was the sort of trouble she didn't need. In fact, the only thing she needed was her rest. She could be home by a quarter to the hour, and that would give her 3 hours' sleep before she'd have to rise and dress for her day job at the pier. When that was over, at evening bell, she'd have an hour to nap before the night shift at the manufactory began. She hurried out through the Templum doors into a cold street where full daylight now shone, and made her weary way back towards her hab. Over the Theden Peninsula, 0737.
"Hunt two, you're making oily smoke!"
The flight leader's anxious voice cut over the vox. There was no immediate response from Hunt two. Darrow sat up in his seat and scanned around in the morning light. The scrub plains and grass breaks of the peninsula swept by, 2,000 meters under him, a wide expanse of greys, dull whites, and speckled greens. Down at his fore were Hunt 8 and Hunt 11, with Hunt Leader running to starboard on the same deck as Darrow himself. Hunt 2 and Hunt 16 were off and low at Darrow's port. Six planes. Six planes were all that was left from the engagement. They'd left all the others as flaming pyres littering the snowcaps of the Macanite Mountains. And it might only have been five. Darrow knew he surely would have been chalked by that white killer had not Hunt Leader, sweeping back in a desperate effort to rally his few remaining machines, run in at the last moment, cannons blazing, and driven it off. Major Heckel, Hunt Leader, kept asking Darrow if he was okay as they pulled what remained of the formation back together. Heckel sounded extraordinarily worried, as if he felt Darrow might have simply scared himself to death in the frantic chase. But it was probably shock and the ache of responsibility. So many cadets dead. One of the squadron's black days. And there had been so many in the last few months. Darrow wondered how officers like the Major coped, But then Heckel was only 3 years Darrow's senior and had gained his rank through the accelerated promotion caused by severe losses. Hud 2, respond! Even over the distorting vox, that tone in Heckel's voice was clear as day. Hunt leader, I'm all right! He wasn't. Darrow had a good angle down at Hunt 2. Not only was he cooking out a steady stream of grubby smoke, he was losing altitude and speed.
What was it? Coolant?
Smouldering electrics? Some other lethal eventuality Darrow hadn't even thought of. How long had they got? By his own map and bearing, they were 46 minutes out from Theta MAB North, longer if Hunt 2 maintained its rate of deceleration. Darrow's fuel gauge still showed full, but by Heckel's calculation, none of them were likely to have more than about 50 minutes in them. Especially not Darrow, given his excessive aerobatics.
Hunt flight!
Heckel's voice came over the comm. He paused, as if frantically trying to make up his mind.
Hunt flight! We're going to divert to Theta South. That should shave 15, maybe 20 minutes off the flying time. Confirm and line up on me.
Darrow confirmed, and heard the others do so too. It was a good decision. Flight Command would rather get 6 wolf cubs back at the wrong MAB than none back at all. Darrow switched channels and heard Heckel banter back and forth with operations as the reroute was authorized. Then he heard the knocking again. He was about to call it in when Hunt 8 began screeching over the vox.
Hunt 2! Look at Hunt 2!
Darrow craned his neck around. The wounded cub was gently arcing down away from the formation. Its smoke trail was thicker and darker now. It looked heavy and sluggish, as if much more gravity was weighing down on it than on the other planes.
Hunt 2, respond! Darrow heard Hunt leader call. Hunt 2, respond!
A faint crackle.
Think I can hold the... Hunt 2, bail for throne's sake, Edry! Cadet Edry, clear your plane now before you lose too much height!
Nothing. The wolf cub was just a dot at the end of a line of smoke far behind and below them now.
Edry! Cadet Edry!
Come on, Edry. Get out of there.
Darrow strained to see. With their fuel load so low, none of them could risk turning back.
Come on, Edry. Come on. Let's see a chute. Let us see a chute, Edry, before...
A small flash, far away in the grey-green quilt of the landscape. A small flash of fire, and no chute at all. Theta MAB South, 0740. By the time the transport turned off the highway onto the field approach way, it had been joined in convoy by 3 others. They waited in turn to be checked off by weary-looking PDF sentries at the west gate and then rumbled on down a steep cutting onto the field basin. Commander Bree Jagdia raised herself up on the hard bench of the jolting transport and looked around. Theda Military Air Base South covered over 20 square kilometers of lowland southwest of the city itself. She could smell the coast a few kilometers north, and the sea air had layered a light morning haze across the field that the sun was just beginning to cook off. Vast defenses ringed the field. Ditches and dikes, blast fences and stake lines, armored nests for Hydra batteries, pillbox emplacements for raised missile cylinders. There was a patched perimeter track, busy at this hour with military trucks and weapons carriers moving both ways, and a leaner inner ring of anti-air batteries. To the south end of the field stood the great housing hangars and rockcrete armories. To the north, operations control and the stark derricks and pylons of the Vox, Auspex, and Modar systems. A hash shape of crossed airstrips covered the main inner area, the primary runways large enough to manage the big, reciprocating engined bombers the locals flew. Jagdia saw a few of them parked on a hardstand in the distance. Magogs, big and old and ugly. They'd used them back home on Fantine during the final offensive, desperate to get aloft anything that could fly and fight. Here, they were a standard bombing mainstay. No wonder Enothians had been punished so hard. But most of the local machines had been shipped out to clear the field for the newcomers. Jagdia and her flight had arrived in darkness the night before. This was their first proper look at the base. It would serve. It would have to. Work gangs from the Munitorum were already busy making field conversions. Laborers were proofing up more hard wall silos for the arriving machines, and in one place were beginning to dozer up one of the old runways to make additional parking bunkers. The newcomers' aircraft, over 70 of them already, were dark shapes under netting in the clusters of anti-blast revetments to the east. There was a muddle of activity, chugging generators, clunking excavators, bare-chested rock drill operators, growing heaps of spoil all across the inner landscape of the field. Jagdeer glanced at the chronograph strapped around the thick cuff of her flight suit. They were right on time. Their transport had left the perimeter track and was bumping towards the nearest of the huge drome hangars.
"Up and ready, Umbra flight," she ordered.
The 11 aviators under her command gathered up their kits as the transport rolled to a stop. Jagdeer jumped down and took a deep breath.
"Here we go,"
she muttered to Millen Blanchard, her number two. Blanchard was a grizzled veteran in his 40s, his career tally of 22 kills the finest in Umbra flight. He said little, but she trusted him with her life. He had unusually pale, distant eyes for a Fantine, and sported a thick grey moustache, partly to lend himself an air of avuncular seniority, mostly to help conceal the ridge of white scar tissue where a piece of shell casing had split his face from his right nostril down across both lips to the point of his chin.
"Here we go indeed," he murmured,
and hoisted his kit onto his shoulder. The others clambered down. Van Tull, Esper, Larisse Ashe with her hair up in a non-regulation bun, Delruth, Clovin, the boy Markwell, Walden forever whistling a melodyless tune, Zemek jangling with his cluster of lucky charms, Cordial, Ranfrey. Almost all of them made the superstitious bob down to touch the ground. Vander Markwell didn't. He was gazing across the field, watching three machines of the Enothian Commonwealth Air Force crank up for launch. They were powerful twin-engine delta-form planes, an interceptor pattern known as cyclones. Started from trolley-mounted primer coils, their massive piston engines sucked and thundered into life, kicking out plumes of blue smoke from the exhaust vents as the heavy props began to turn to a flickering blur. They rocked impatiently at their blocks as the ground crews rolled the carts aside. Markwell could see the two-man crews in the glass-nose cockpits making final checks. Though most Commonwealth wings had been withdrawn to make way for the off-worlders, a flight of these cyclones had been left on station to fly top-cover tours while the Imperials bedded in.
"Coming, Markwell?"
Jagdeer asked. He turned and nodded.
"Yes, Commander."
Markwell was the youngest aviator in Umbra by 4 years, and the only one with no operational combat experience. Everyone else had seen at least some action during the Fantine liberation. Markwell had still been in the accelerated program at Hessenville when hostilities ended. He was eager, and Jagdeer believed reasonably gifted, but only time would really tell his worth. He had the classic saturnine good looks of a Fantine male and a white, toothy grin that people either found winningly charming or unpleasantly cocky. Umbra flight strode off across the apron towards the hangar, followed by another flight of aviators spilling down from a second transport. Jagdeer took a glance back at their own ride. In the cab, the Munitorum driver nodded briefly to her. She could clearly see how one half of his face was lost in burn scarring, as if soft pink rose petals had been plastered across his skin. They walked into the vast drome hangar. The air inside smelled cold and damp, with a tang of promethium. The interior space had been cleared, except for a lone shrike under tarps in a corner, and a stage of flakboards supported by empty munition crates had been raised along the west wall. A chart stand and a hololithic displayer had been set up on the staging. A group of more than 20 aviators was already waiting inside. They stood near the stage, their kit bags at their feet. Like the men who had come off the second truck, they were Navy pilots, wearing grey flight armor and black coats. Some of them sported augmetic eyes. They greeted their colleagues from the second truck, but both groups looked dubiously at the Fantine as they came in, and stayed apart from them in segregated groups. Jagdeer regarded them casually as Umbra flight dropped their bags and made a huddle. The Navy flyers kept glancing their way. Jagdeer knew the Fantine Corps was unusual, and that set them apart from the regular Imperial aviators. It undoubtedly would mean rivalry and a pecking order, she accepted. They were tough-looking brutes, sturdy and thick-set, with pale skins and cropped hair. Most of their flight suits were reinforced with plating sections or coats of chainmail, and their heavy leather coats were often fur-trimmed. Many had ugly facial scars. Several displayed medal ribbons and other honor sashes.
63rd Imperial Fighter Wing,
Blanchard whispered discreetly in her ear.
The Sundogs, as they like to be styled. I believe that one there, the big fellow with the flight commander pins, is Alexander Godel. 40 kills, last count.
Yes, I've heard of him,
she answered lightly.
The other bunch are the 409 Raptors, I believe,
Blanche went on.
Which would make that unassuming fellow there, wing leader Ortho Blager.
The same?
The very same. 110 kills. See? He's looking at us.
Then let's look somewhere else, Jagdeer said, and turned away.
Orbis at your six!
Pilot Officer Zemek suddenly cried out loudly, his voice echoing round the drome. Dismounting from another transport just now drawn up outside, a dozen more Fantine flyers were marching into the hangar. Jagdeer felt instant relief at the sight of familiar faces. Orbis flight, comrades and friends. At the head of them strolled their commander, Willem Hayes. The two wings clustered together and greeted each other.
Nice of you to join us, Jagdeer grinned, as she shook Hayes by the hand.
Nice of you to wait for us, Hayes replied. I trust there are still some bats flying for us to hunt.
A hush suddenly fell. A final group of aviators, all Navy men, had just entered the hangar, making a late entrance that seemed to Jagdeer calculatedly theatrical. There were only eight of them. Their armored flight suits were matte black, and their suede jackets cloud white. They wore no insignia or rank markings whatsoever, except silver imperial aquilae at their collars.
Holy crap,
Jagdeer heard Del Ruth whisper.
The apostles.
The apostles, indeed. The celebrated wing of aces, the very elite. Jagdeer wondered which one was Quint, ace of aces, which one Gettering. The tall one, was that Sekan or Halson? Which one was Sur? There was no time to ask Blanche. Escorted by a dozen aides and tactical officers, an imposing figure in the uniform of a fleet admiral came in and took the stage. It was Ornoff himself. All eyes turned to him.
Aviators, he began,
his voice soft but carrying.
At 1800 hours yesterday evening, I met with Lord Militant Hummel in the War Ministry at Enothopolis. The Lord Militant, as you must be aware, has been prosecuting the war here on Enothis for the last 9 months, in the name of War Master Makaroth and the God Emperor of us all.
The Emperor protects, one of the apostles said smartly, and everyone eagerly echoed the words. Ornoff nodded appreciatively.
I hope he does, Captain Gettering. In the meantime, we will have to do. I presented the formal orders sent to me by the War Master to Lord Militant Hummel, and at 1830 hours precisely, the Lord Militant formally handed command of the Enothis Theatre to me.
Spontaneous applause broke out across the hangar floor.
For now, the land war on Enothis is done. Now the air war begins.
Theda MAB South, 0746. Major Franz Sculter glanced at the co-pilot alongside him in the cramped bubble canopy of the thundering cyclone, got a thumbs up, then turned to wave the ground crew off. He adjusted his mask.
Operations, operations. This is Seeker One. Seeker Flight is ready for departure. Awaiting permission.
Sculter had his hand on the wheel brake lever.
Seeker One, operations. Roll them out. Main is open. Fly true, and may the Emperor protect you.
Thank you, operations. Seeker Flight, on my lead.
Sculter released the brake and opened the throttle gently. Bucking, the twin-engined plane began to creep out off the hardstand towards the main runway. Its wingmen followed. The combined roar of the six engines resounded across the field. Sculter rolled to the start position and made a final adjustment to the trim. At his side, Artone opened the radiators and made the fuel mix a little richer for a lusty takeoff.
Seeker Flight,
Sculter began. Artone suddenly held up a hand.
What?
Red flag,
said Artone urgently, pointing down the field.
Throne? What now?
Snarled Sculter.
Operations, this is Seeker One. We've got a red flag. Please confirm our clearance.
There was a pause. Then the vox fizzled.
Negative clearance. Negative clearance, Seeker Flight. Abort now and clear main. Roll off to revetments 15 through 17 and stand down. Repeat. Negative clearance. Abort and clear main.
What the hell's going on?
Sculter demanded.
Wounded birds, the vox replied. Wounded birds inbound.
20 kilometers short of Theda MAB South. 0746. They could see the spread of the field, slightly hazy in the morning light. Guide paths were popping off. The knocking from behind Darrow was now constant. Major Heckel called in the fuel load from each cub in turn. All were miserably low.
Darrow could only answer full, as he had no other reading. Hunt 16 had begun to dribble smoke in the last 10 minutes, and its pilot reported rapidly dropping hydraulic pressure. Hunt 16 had taken at least 2 hits to the belly during the brawl over the mountains.
Hunt flight, this is Hunt leader. 16 and 4 have landing priority. Let them go in first, and we'll follow as soon as they're down. Confirm.
Darrow stretched his shoulders against the harness. Heckle wanted 16 down before it died, and he wanted Darrow down as quickly because he was most likely flying on empty.
After you, Hunt 16, Darrow voxed,
allowing the wolf cub to come around ahead of him. The cub's streamer of smoke pulsed clear, then white, like a ticker tape. The knocking grew yet more insistent. Darrow began his approach. Theda MAB South, 0747.
Your fighter wings, Ornoff told them, are 5 of the first to arrive on station here along the southern coast. In the next 72 hours, a total of 58 wings of the Imperial Navy and its affiliates, he added, with a nod to the Fantine, will be deployed at airfields along the entire littoral. 42 fighter wings, 16 bomber flights. To say that you will be supporting the local Commonwealth squadrons here is a misstatement. You will form the front line in the air. The stalwart Commonwealth forces who have, let me remind you, been fighting this theater for months now, will take a supportive role. God Emperor willing, this may allow them precious time to repair, refit, recrew, and rest.
He turned to the chart behind him.
I don't need to tell you to familiarize yourself with the topography, channel use, and the location of friendly fields. Encryption codes will be changed on a daily basis. The arch enemy is listening.
Ornoff paused and slid his open hand down the chart pensively.
The situation here is grave. Lord Militant Hummel's land forces, ably supported by the Commonwealth armies, almost succeeded in driving the arch-enemy off this world. However, in the last 2 months, fortunes have reversed disastrously. The arch-enemy, whose remaining surface stronghold is around the southern Trinity Hives, here, has resupplied in great force as part of the counteroffensive launched last year through the Khan Group as a whole. The Lord Militant's land forces are now in harried retreat northwards through the interior desert, this region here. Some have already reached the Machanite Range and are struggling through the passes there. Our task, your task, is to help as many of them reach the safety of the Siphonian coast as possible. We are to supply comprehensive air cover to the retreating columns of armor and infantry. That means denying the enemy airspace and prosecuting their land forces with aerial strikes. Enothis will only be saved if sufficient portions of Allied land forces can be brought back to the coast intact. There, with resupply, they can make a stand, a counterattack to meet the arch-enemy invasion.
Ornoff looked back at them all.
Expect to be flying sorties round the clock. A thorough strategic plan will be executed as soon as all the wings are on station, at which point your wings may be reassigned to other fields. In the meantime, you'll be flying ad hoc missions at the discretion of operations to supply cover until we are at full strength.
Ornoff raised a hand and beckoned one of the staffers, who had entered the hangar with him, onto the stage, an older man in the flight kit of a Commonwealth pilot officer.
I've invited Commander Parwood here to brief you on climate and terrain peculiarities. Before he does, any questions?
Godel, the Sun Dog's flight commander, raised a gloved hand.
What are we to expect here, Admiral?
Superior air power, Ornoff replied crisply. Hellraiser and Locust-class fighters, Tormentor and Hell-Talon-class fighter bombers. The arch-enemy is flying a large number of locally made machines. There are also reports of heavy bombers of a type yet undetermined. Many of their planes exhibit extended range, which may indicate mass carriers in the desert.
When do we get in their reach? One of the apostles asked.
Unless you deny them, Major Sewer, at their present rate of progress, the arch-enemy wings will have range enough to begin attacking these coastal bases within the month. That is an eventuality I don't want to see.
And you won't, Admiral, said Sewer, because we will deny them.
There was a general murmur of approval.
Now, if Commander Parwood would be so kind, we...
Ornoff's words were cut off as a hooter began to drone outside. In a moment, it was chorused by others. A deep, ominous moaning wailed out across the field. The aviators exchanged glances. Ornoff looked at his aides and hurried off the stage, heading for the hangar doors. Everyone followed. Outside, in the bright sunlight, they clustered on the rock-crete apron, scanning the glassy sky. Path lights had been lit along the main runway track, and recovery vehicles were growling out of the sheds along the north perimeter.
"Someone's in trouble,"
Blancher muttered. "There," one of the Navy pilots called, pointing. Low in the southern sky, tiny dots. Jagdia heard the distant, burping putter of pulse jets.
"That's low," said Ash.
Several of the dots were hanging back, but two were hoving in. They could see sunlight flare off canopies. The lead plane, a little dark green monojet, was dragging a string of vapor behind it.
"Not good," said Jagdia, staring.
Beside her, Markwell said,
"What? If he's going to land, let's hope he gets his cart down."
Over Theda MAB South, 0751. The smoke coming out of Hunt 16 was getting thicker, and had started to plume out fat and heavy as their airspeed dropped. Darrow had to adjust height to stop himself flying in blind through the vapor. Hunt 16 was pitching low, and it forced Darrow to sit up high, higher than he would have preferred for an approach. There was a slight crosswind. He felt his tail skidding, and he trimmed to compensate. According to the airspeed indicator, he was getting dangerously near critical stall.
"Come on, Hunt 16, he cursed. "Come on, Fryce. Get that bird down."
"Hold your water," the Vox chattered. I think my bloody cart's hung."
"Clear it, Fryce," Darrow heard Hunt leader urge over the channel. "Trying. Damn thing's stuck. Levers jammed. Bent, I think."
A bleeper sounded in Darrow's cockpit. Fuel out, even though the damn gauge still read full.
"I've got to sit, now," he called.
Okay, it's all right, Enric. I've got it now. Levers pulled. Cart down." Over Theda MAB South, 0751. Even as the Cyclone's engines whistled down to a dying chop, Sculter wrenched open the window slider of the canopy and stuck his head out, searching the sky.
"Operations!" he yelled,
but then realized that pushing his head out of the window had pulled his mic cord to full extent and yanked the plug out of the Vox panel.
"Damn it,"
he yelled, struggling back inside and banging his head.
"Damn it!"
He fumbled for the end of the cord.
"Got it,"
cried Artone, ramming the plug back into its socket.
"Operations, get a flag up! Signal! That cub's coming in with its undercart up!"
"Clear the channel, Seeker."
Sculter clunked off his harness, threw open the side hatch, and fell out onto the ground. Artone was fast on his heels. The crews of the Cyclones in the revetment bunkers next to them had dismounted too. Sculter ran up the embankment towards the main strip, waving his arms. Red flares had gone up over the field. Bleeding smoke, one wing hanging heavy, the wolf cub was really low. The noise of its pulse jet was a drawn-out, plosive blurt. Its undercart was locked up in its belly.
"Up! Up!"
Sculter yelled. He fell on his face as Artone tackled him and brought him down short of the rock-crete track. The wolf cub came in, over, and passed them both. Just shy of stall speed, it began to drop its tail, about to settle onto gear that wasn't there. The underside of the tail hit first. There was an abrasive shriek. Metal shards and grit flew up in a hot grind of friction. Immediately, the tail came back up, bouncing, pitching the wolf cub down straight on its nose. The interceptor came apart, shredding aluminoid off its frame. The port wing crumpled and flew off. The pulse jet, coughing flames, sheared off its mounts, crushed the already buckled cockpit, and detonated as it lifted clear. Liquid flame boiled out across the runway. High on its six, Darrow stared in disbelief. He'd just lowered his own undercart, and the added drag had dwindled his speed even more. There was no runway anymore, just a lake of fire and a mass of tangled wreckage.
"Abort, Hunt 4!"
Darrow slammed on full emergency thrust and trimmed for maximum lift. His cub shook and fought, tired of flying now. He hauled on the stick. Jet screaming, Hunt 4 cleared the debris by scant meters and zoomed through the leaping fireball of the crash. Darrow's canopy blackened with soot. There was smoke everywhere. As he came clear, he saw loose flame dancing along his wings.
"Request secondary runway," he yelled. "Runway is clear," the Vox sang.
He came around, rising and turning as tightly as he dared. He wouldn't stall. Not now. Not now. The stick was like lead. He came about onto the track, dropping fast but true. He had it now. Red lights fluttered across his instruments. He felt a lurch. The engine had flamed out. Zero fuel or nothing like enough airspeed, he couldn't tell which. Didn't have time. Didn't care. The wolf cub fell out of the air onto the ragged runway. The undercart survived the first hard bounce, but not the second. It disintegrated in a scatter of chrome struts and torn rubber. The machine made a third bounce on its belly, cascading sparks into the air. Body plating ripped away. The slide went wide, turning the dented nose cone right, folding a wing like paper. Darrow screamed, his arms over his face, shaken like a bead in a tin. They came running from all directions, from the silos, from the fitter barns, from the main hangar. Recovery trucks, their hooters blaring, kicked up dust and stones as they raced over the verge sides. Jagdeer and Blanchard were amongst the first of the aviators to reach the wreck.
"Back! Get back!" a tender driver screamed at them.
"Get him out, then!"
Jagdeer yelled back, slamming past the barrier of the man's outstretched arms. The canopy hood of the downed cub wrenched backwards, and the pilot dragged himself out. His plane was almost on its side, pinning a broken wing under it, surrounded by debris. He staggered towards them, shaking his head dizzily as the crash crews ran in towards the wreck with retardant sprays. The young man's face was black with soot and oil. When he pulled off the breather mask, his lower face was pink and clean. He blinked at Jagdeer and Blanchard.
"Shit," he said.
"Good landing,"
Blanchard said, offering an arm to support him. The pilot sagged heavily, shaking.
"Good landing," he coughed.
Blanchard smiled.
"You walked away from it, didn't you?"